I've got Trent from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Good morning, Trent.
Hey, good morning. You know, yesterday was a pretty active day throughout the Wasatch Range. I think the biggest news came from the Piperhorn. Most people have probably heard about this now, but four riders, they were boot packing up in the East Ridge to summit the Piperhorn, and they triggered a pretty shallow 2 to 6 inch deep wind slab. You know, it did break kind of wide. The photo makes it look about 100 feet wide, but all four people were caught and carried in that avalanche. And unfortunately, there's a rock band kind of mid-slope off the backside there of the Piperhorn, and they went over that, and everybody got pretty banged up and bruised, and two people suffered a pretty bad leg injury, possibly some a broken leg. Luckily, they were finally able to get them out of there yesterday about 6 p.m. The winds finally let up enough to let a helicopter come on in and got everybody down and safe off the mountain. So we're happy about that. But outside of that accident, there were also 13 other new avalanches reported to the Utah Avalanche Center, with another three people being caught and carried in those avalanches. All of these avalanches are wind slabs. And really, over the past 36 hours, the wind has blown from different directions at speeds of 20 to 30 miles per hour with gusts into the 60s. This morning, the winds are a little bit more calm, but, you know, that doesn't matter because the damage has kind of been done. And the winds also blew from the east, which is a little bit unusual for us. So I would expect some unusual drifts in locations that we might not think of. But, you know, the recipe is pretty simple. If we have some new snow and we have some wind, it equals avalanches. And really, today will be no different from yesterday, as lingering drifts of windblown snow will remain sensitive to the weight of humans. And, you know, most of these wind slabs are 5 to 18 inches deep and about 50 feet wide. So if you think about terrain and just consequences with me for a second, imagine just a nice smooth slope with no trees or nothing down in the runout zone. These avalanches are, you know, not really big enough to bury us. I guess if you were, you know, pushed face down, laying flat, maybe these could bury you. But really the problem is with these types of avalanches is the terrain that we're in. So if you're up above a cliff band, or, you know, if you get caught in one of these little avalanches and you get slammed into trees or rocks, and of course, terrain traps where the snow can obviously pile up much deeper than like this big, smooth, open slope, the consequences of these small avalanches change. And so I think that's really the big thing to key in on, is that we do have some unstable snow. The avalanches aren't that big, but they're everywhere at the mid and upper elevations. And really, we have a moderate danger on all aspects. So mid and upper elevations for triggering a fresh slab of wind-drifted snow. So really, you know, you need to look for and avoid steep slopes that have recently been loaded by the wind. The bummer news is that most all slopes have been loaded by the wind or have some sort of wind slab on them. That's at least what I found yesterday out in the backcountry. And I toned it way down. We stuck lower into the trees where the snow is much softer. And I think if you're finding soft powder snow, there's a low danger there. If the snow is upside down, cakey, slabby feeling, that's how you identify that you are in a wind-loaded section or a wind-padded area. And that'd be, you know, my guard would be up for any slope steeper than 30 degrees there. And, you know, it's also springtime, so the sun is strong. And for if some reason the clouds give way to clear skies, either this morning or early afternoon, we always want to be on the lookout for that snow surface becoming wet. And really the first sign of wet snow is rollerballs, and then loose wet avalanches, again, should always be on our mind this time of year. So that's basically what's going on in the backcountry. It is a little bit, I don't know what the right word is for it, but a little sensitive out there, especially from those winds. The good news is this is a new snow avalanche problem, or, you know, we're not dealing with that old weak layer or faceted snow. So this should stabilize in just the next few days. But for today, it's going to remain sensitive to the weight of riders.
Hey, Trent, thanks. And we'll have a look at the weather on the phone with us. I've got meteorologist Adam Carroll. Hi, Adam.
Hi there. I hope everyone had a nice weekend as we start a new week ahead. And today will be, for the most part, a quiet day. We will see some increasing southerly winds, though, in and around Park City in the Wasatch Back, heading into the afternoon hours ahead of a new storm system that arrives late tonight across southern Utah and eventually brings in a little bit of precipitation into northern Utah overnight into tomorrow morning. Not expecting a whole lot in terms of additional snow, at least for the Park City proper area, maybe an inch. But overall, this is another central and southern type of storm that's shaping up here. And we're going to be in, at least for daytime highs today, we'll be in the upper 40s. 47 will be the high today. 43 tomorrow, so a little cooler. As this storm system moves off to the east, brings in that little wraparound moisture, and we'll end up seeing it all come to an end later tomorrow evening throughout the majority of the area. But then we'll actually start breaking out some more sunshine to end the week as temperatures start warming into the 50s for Thursday, Friday, but the winds again will increase ahead of a new storm system. So that will arrive on Saturday, bringing our temperatures back down into the low to mid 40s with more rain and snow chances here. And then, of course, snow in the mountains. And this might even linger into the Sunday time frame. But these aren't heavy hitting storms, unfortunately, but it does bring us some precipitation. And as Drent said, in the backcountry, it's is going to be an area to watch, especially with this next round of storms coming in here both tomorrow and heading into the weekend. But overall, most of the week is mainly quiet, with the exception of really just tomorrow before we head into that weekend. So if you can, go out and enjoy the warming temperatures as we head into the latter half of the week.
Okay, Adam, thanks so much.
You bet.
Good morning. Well, the Park City Board of Education spent time in a work session last week looking at a new demographic study, as well as a report on a master plan implementation. On the phone with a recap of what's next, Park City School District Business Administrator Todd Hauberg.
Good morning.
Why was a new demographic study needed?
So about every 5 years, we would go through the process of updating the studies. As you look at a demographic study, they're fairly confident about 5 years out, and then the confidence interval drops as you go to 10 years out. And so we're about 5 years into our next cycle.
Okay, so what changed with this study compared to the one that was done 5 years ago?
Yeah, so there was a noticeable change. 5 years ago, we were expecting growth to be pretty solid and consistent over that 5-year period, and we've actually experienced about flat growth to a little bit of decline, and so that was a new dynamic that came into the study.
Yeah, and we have heard, though, that a lot of people this year, I mean, are you factoring in this year's registration numbers, enrollment numbers?
Yes, so the study itself looked at the difference between the 2019 enrollments and the 2020 enrollments, and also went back over the prior 4 years to establish kind of the baseline or the natural growth of what's happening within our area. And then the second part of the study is then looking at development and forecasting what the student loads might be that come from the new development.
Yeah, but we know that people didn't enroll this year just due to the pandemic. So are those numbers not correct given going forward? Or how do we know?
Sure. Well, you never know. It's a forecast, so you don't know for certain. We just try to take out some of the extremes and the unknown. But looking back over the past 5 years, so the total of last year and the 4 years before that, that gives us some statistical basis to look forward. This last year definitely had some different challenges to it, but in the end, the final numbers came out about what we had forecasted for the year. So we typically expect 120 to 150 students to move out of the system, and at least that many to move into the system. So we kind of stay status quo, if you will. And so that, from that perspective, the numbers really didn't change. Looking forward, we have the 5-year basis that we're using to try to project into the future years, what that might look like.
Well, so we know that the fertility rates in Utah are the lowest they've been in 50 years, and we're suspecting that the increasing cost of living here is getting more and more difficult for families with children. So what do we do? I mean, going, what does this mean then, moving forward from a planning standpoint?
So for as far as planning for schools, we have to take those into consideration and anticipate what we think the family types will be that move in, the ages of the students when they move in, and just make sure that we have a very solid public education system in place for those families when they do arrive.
So there's some 27 development projects under construction or being planned within the school district. How much does that impact enrollment?
That does. So that is really offsetting the natural decline that's happening because of the birth rate that you just mentioned. And so we're anticipating, you know, somewhere between 300 to 500 students coming in through that process, and then we have our natural decline that's happening. So there's somewhat of an offset, but it's not a total offset. So the projection indicates that there's a decline over the next 5 years and then into the next 10.
And did you factor in the Dakota Pacific project?
Yes, we did. That was one of the projects that we at least had enough information on and had a general idea of timeline. But those all can change as the developer moves through the process. So at this point, we have a snapshot of what we could anticipate, and then we'll wait for reality to catch up.
Okay. And if, in fact, it doesn't get approved, then we're going to be the growth would be even less, yeah?
Yeah, so if any of the larger two projects don't come online, then yeah, the decline could even be more.
So do we need new school buildings?
So from the standpoint of the functionality of the school buildings and the need to accommodate the grade realignment, definitely. We have facilities that could be better for the future learning environments that we're looking at. With the better flexible space, the better traffic flows through the buildings, and as well as the desire that we have coming from the board and from the community that the ninth graders really need to be in the ninth grade building and having that full high school experience, and then having the eighth graders join their other grades for a solid middle school, junior high experience.
Well, then let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, how... Let's move to the master planning documents. I mean, it looks like we're down to three options for the Kearns campus. So let's run through those. We've got option A, which is known as the Eastern build. We're talking about an $88 million build with up to four more phases. And in this case, we would tear down the Eccles Center and McPullen Elementary?
No. So what we're looking at is an idea for the current campus that could go for the next 20 years. Specifically, what we're looking at right now today is what will it take to bring those ninth graders into the high school and improve that space for the high school. So that's what we call phase one, and the phase one on that construction is about $53.5 million. That's really what we're contemplating. So when we look at the options that will go before the board tomorrow afternoon, that option is one. There's then the other, the eastern side build, that's a second option. And then the third one is, I wouldn't really call it an option at this point. We've had enough individuals come forward to say, well, if you're going to spend that much money, why don't you just build a new high school? And so we put that out there as a point of reference, so that people could see, here's what the remodel costs, here's what a new high school would cost, so that they could see the differential and hopefully appreciate that we're trying to put together the least cost scenario that impacts the priorities to the greatest degree.
So that's also called option A, but it's just a new build, $176 million. It basically demolishes the high school?
Yeah, it's just what would it take to build a new high school?
Okay, so I guess I'm confused because you're talking about option B is that $53 million phase one, but mm-hmm. also has four phases, and it's called the Western Bill. So and it looks like also that the Eccles Center is torn down, but yet puts an addition onto McPullen, whereas the option A, at least in the photos, again, we couldn't hear the conversation.
Sure.
So maybe you need to...
Definitely. So the option B, the only thing under consideration right now is phase one, which is the new build or the remodel for the ninth grade in the CTE space. That's really the only thing under conversation at this point. When we had talked to the architects about what could the future of the Kearns campus look like, there was then remodels of the rest of the high school, which includes the Eccles space, but it's not a teardown, it's a remodel. Mm-hmm. By the time we get there, you know, that could be 5-10 years out, it will be time to address that space anyway in the high school. So it's just a natural consideration as you look at the full development of the high school. But I wouldn't interpret it to be any teardown or elimination. It's just it's time to remodel when we get to that point.
Okay, and then what happens to Treasure Mountain Junior High School?
Good question. So at this point, we want to have also a priority of minimal impact on our students. So the Treasure Mountain High School, through all of this construction phasing, will provide space for the students to continue to learn in to minimize the disruption from the construction. So its purpose right now would be to be school space, education space, through the duration of the projects. And then we can talk about what the future of the Kearns campus looks like at that point.
Okay, so eventually it would go away?
I believe in the drawings that is the contemplation, that if we pull the grades out, ninth grade to the high school and eighth grade over to Ecker, the future use of that building has a lot of questions. And if we also want to address some of the traffic impacts, having the high school traffic and the elementary school traffic off of Kearns and onto an internal circulation pattern, that becomes a space that could help to alleviate some of those pressures.
All right, and then where does the expansion of McPolin fit in to all of this? I guess the expansion of all of the elementaries.
Sure. So that was priority three. Again, priority one being the high school, priority two being Ecker, priority three addressing the early learning opportunities, and so the build-outs that would happen at each of the elementary schools to support that. That's a priority three, and at this point, we'll be seeking direction from the board as to, do we go to priority three at this time, or is that something that will wait its turn?
All right, let's look at the Ecker Hill campus then. We've got, again, also three options, one including a brand new build. I can't figure out, again, you just put that out because you felt like you needed to put it out?
Yes, same questions were asked. Well, if you're going to do that much work over at the Ecker, why don't you just build a new one? And so we just put it out, again, as a point of reference. Here's what remodels are costing. Here's what a new middle school would cost, point of reference. And you can see that we're trying to do the lowest cost option out there to have the greatest academic impact.
Okay, so we're talking about a $35 million addition and remodel. How is that different from the option B, $41 million, three different additions and remodel?
Good question. So what we're looking at in the option A is just taking the current architecture that's there at Ecker and adding the additional classrooms that would be needed as wings off of the main hub of the school there. Option B actually eliminates that west side of the building to straighten out the school. And so you have kind of like a main street corridor that runs across the whole school, and the classes are off of that hallway. So it's more of a design impact and a deeper remodel. So the cost reflects that deeper remodel.
All right, so at this point, the board's preference is to move forward with the $53 million remodel for the high school and the $35 million remodel for Ecker Hill?
Yes, that was the general feel that came out of the work session last week. So we've had the intervening time to allow board members to look through that, think through it, identify any other clarifying questions that they might have. And then hopefully tomorrow night we'll receive the final direction and be able to talk more specifically about where things are going.
All right. You did mention the CTE project as part of the remodeled high school. What about the PC CAPS and the Learning Center?
Yep. So the CTE is a probably a broader umbrella for the idea that the PC caps can fall under. So the PC cap space is part of that CTE solution that we're looking at the high school. The Learning Center will be programmatically considered to see how best to serve those students and whether bringing them into the high school is an appropriate setting or to maintain the Learning Center where it is.
Okay, and what's the timeline on this?
As far as completing the projects or getting to a decision?
Well, you said sounds like tomorrow could be some decision making, but I mean, if things move forward, we get a bond passes. I mean, we're starting like this summer?
Yeah, so we could, in theory, start design work over the summer so that we're ready once, say, we go to the general bond and the election is successful in supporting the ideas. We could have everything pulled together and ready for construction season next spring.
Okay. So is that the plan, though, to move forward with an $88 million bond?
I believe the idea is to move forward with that option. And then also at Tuesday's meeting, we'll be talking about financing options of how we might be able to move forward to support that level of construction.
Okay. Have you guys figured out the sound system yet? Because it's still inaudible for somebody to go
apparently
online.
Not. I thought we had it under control, but apparently not.
No, I don't know. I don't know if I sent you the audio. I'll be happy to forward it to you.
Sure.
But
yeah,
so if people want to be part of this discussion, I mean, it's so difficult for them to be because they can't go online and hear clearly, especially if you got somebody on the phone. And I guess it's just like if you want feedback, it seems to me that, I mean, they have to show up then with a mask? I mean, how many people can you get lit in that room?
Oh, yeah, we have room for people to come, and we'll be able to accommodate that. So please come. If these are things that you want to be involved with firsthand, please come.
Okay. What time?
So the board meeting on Tuesday is at 4 p.m.
All right. And then are lease revenue bonds still an option here?
So all of the financing options are still out there. So, yes, lease revenue bonds will be part of the conversation on Tuesday.
Okay. What else do you think people need to know?
Just take the opportunity to look at the plans and see that they're reflecting the conversations we've had actually over the last 2 years and give us feedback to make sure we're on the right path.
All right. Hey, Todd, appreciate your time this morning.
You're welcome.
That's Park City School District Business Administrator Todd Halber. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. On the phone with me now with an update from U.S. Ski and Snowboard, I have cross-country communications manager Tom Horrocks. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's kick off with Alpine. How are things looking there?
Yeah, great, great last week for us in Alpine. Good to see some of our younger skiers also stepping up. AJ Hurt won the bronze medal in the slalom at the Alpine World Junior Ski Championships in Bulgaria last week. She was the first American woman to podium in slalom since her teammate Paula Molson won gold there in 2015. Heading back to the World Cup circuit on the Alpine side last week, Michaela Schifrin was third in Friday's slalom to lead three Americans into the top 25 and Ore Sweden. Despite a mistake, she made a pretty dramatic recovery to grab that podium finish. So congratulations to her. Paula Molson also matched her career best fifth World Cup result, finishing in ninth. And then on Saturday, on her 26th birthday, Michaela Schifrin took a lead into the second run of the slalom. And she also had some company there. Paula Molson skied to a career fifth place finish there as well. And Michaela, of course, coming out with the win on Saturday. So it was, I'm sorry, she was
second.
I believe. Look, I'm missing my results here, but she had a podium again on Saturday. So congratulations again to Michaela.
Yeah.
But of course, the big news coming this weekend in cross country.
Okay, well, let's move to
Jesse Diggins wrapped up. Jesse Diggins wrapped up the overall World Cup title and the distance World Cup title, becoming the first American since Bill Koch won the title back in 1982. And Jesse is also the first American woman to ever win the World Cup title and the World Cup distance title. So congratulations to her. She wrapped up the weekend with a fifth place finish on Saturday. in the 10K Classic Mass Start and finished fourth in yesterday's 30K Freestyle Pursuit. And it was a big finish for her yesterday, finishing fourth, because she needed to wrap up that distance title, and she ended up nipping Sweden's Ebba Andersson by 13 points to win that title. So congratulations to Jesse. Also a huge finish on the World Cup circuit for Park City's Rosie Brennan. Rosie finished fourth overall in both the overall World Cup standings and the World Cup distance standings. She was 12th in yesterday's race, and of course, Rosie had a phenomenal season this year. Last year, she was 16th in the World Cup standings, 14th in the World Cup distance standings, so by far her best season ever. And she wore that World Cup leader's bib for quite a while in the first part of the season before surrendering it to her teammate, Jesse Diggins. On the men's side, it's been really, really, really refreshing to see a lot of the guys stepping up, especially in our distance races. The previous week at the World Championships, we saw Scott Patterson finish 10th in the 50K Classic in Oberstdorf, Germany. And this past weekend, Gus Schumacher finished 20th in yesterday's final race, which was a 50K freestyle pursuit. He ended up leading the American men in the World Cup standings, finishing 30th overall. And to note, he was also one of the top three U23 athletes in the World Cup overall. So wrapping up the World Cup cross-country season, a lot of our athletes hopped on a plane in Munich this morning, and they are heading back to the United States as we speak, and they're very excited to get back. Most of them have not been back home in about 4 to 5 months, so I'll be very excited to get back to the United States.
I bet. Okay, let's turn to the free ski snowboard teams.
So free ski snowboard teams, we've had some serious success over in Aspen, Colorado, which we were very fortunate, the great partner picking up the World Championships, marking the second time the U.S. has hosted the World Championships back-to-back. As you recall, we hosted them in Park City just 2 years ago. And Jamie Anderson kicked off the World Championships by taking a silver medal in slopestyle on Friday. So it was great to see Jamie back on the podium. And then on Friday, we also saw U.S. freeski team member Burke Irving earning a halfpipe bronze medal in his first World Championships medal appearance. So that was good to see. Also, Aspen local Alex Ferreira finished fourth for the U.S. And then on the women's side in freeski halfpipe, 16-year-old Basalt local there just down the road from Aspen. She put on an impressive show, just missing the podium and claiming fourth in the women's halfpipe. And then Saturday, we had some great performances as well. Kicked it off with an impressive performance by U.S. freeski team men. The U.S. Athletes Colby Stevenson took the silver in the slopestyle, and Alex Hall took the bronze. So that was really good to see. And then Park City, you know, as we know, Hall is a Park City local, and he was also a top qualifier. So it was good to see him step up to the plate as well. And the World Championships do continue in Aspen tomorrow with the Big Air.
Okay. And then moving on to the freestyle team.
So the freestyle team is in Almaty, Kazakhstan, and unfortunately they had some weather issues yesterday that canceled the mogul competition. But Kai Owens did lead the Americans in moguls last week with a fifth place finish in her first World Championships appearance. So that was really good. Unfortunately, the team struggled a little bit. Tess Johnson was one of the top Americans in the top 10, and Hannah Soar finished, Tess Johnson was fifth, Hannah Soar sixth, Kai Owens 10th, and Brad Wilson finished ninth, and local Nick Page was 10th, and that was last week. The good news is the freestyle team did win the Nations Cup, so that's a remarkable achievement for all the athletes and the coaching staff, and especially in this challenging season, to walk away with the Nations Cup is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, sure is. Okay, anything else?
That's it. Big weekend coming up in Aspen, of course, with the Big Air tomorrow, and then the U.S. Grand Prix coming up Friday, Saturday for freeski and slopestyle. For freeski slopestyle, freeski snowboard, snowboard slopestyle, and snowboard halfpipe.
Okay. Hey, thanks.
Thanks, Leslie.
Good morning. Well, last Thursday night, City Council meeting in Park City had two main topics. What's the summer events calendar might look like, and an update from the city's housing department on the potential for future public-private development projects. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more.
If there's one thing everyone could agree on Thursday night, it's that summer 2021 will not look like summer 2020. With vaccinations steadily ramping up across the country, it really looks like at least some of the summer events Park City is known for, like the 4th of July festivities, could return to the calendar. Just how many of those events will return and what they'll actually look like is another question entirely. Long story short, nobody knows what the state of the COVID-19 pandemic will be in 3 months when the first events of the summer are on the city's tentative events schedule. The concern right now is over how the city might attempt to limit the size or at least attempt to spread out crowds at events like the 4th of July, which routinely attract tens of thousands of visitors to town for the holiday. Councillor Steve Joyce told KPCW on Friday that, at least right now, there are no easy and obvious answers to how to successfully pull off safe events this summer.
There's a lot of people who really, you know, are feeling the urge to get back to something like normal. And I think if there was a way, you know, if you could kind of do a thing that says, well, this year, the 4th of July is only going to be for locals. And so instead of having 40 or 50,000 people, we're going to have 5,000. Well, okay, that would be nice, but I don't know how to make that happen. I mean, quite frankly, I think it's impossible.
City staff received direction from council to work on some scaled-back event plans that still include current COVID-19 health and safety measures. They will also be encouraging event applicants to be creative and flexible with their plans given the still uncertain nature of the pandemic. Council also received an update from the Housing Department and discussed the viability of exploring future partnerships between the city and private developers as an effort to cut construction costs, which have steadily increased in recent years. Part of the presentation from city staff included a breakdown of average incomes for the workforce in Park City. The data showed that the majority of Park City's workforce would actually not have access to the city's affordable housing offerings as they are currently priced. Affordable housing at Woodside Park, the Central Park condos, and the Retreat is priced between 70 and 89% of the city's average median income, which, according to the city, is roughly $80,000. According to the city's findings, the average single worker only makes 61% of the AMI on average, 40% for a family of four. Joyce called the findings a wake-up call.
So I think it was a real wake-up call that there's a lot of key positions that are at, you know, 40 or 50 or 60% AMI. And most of what we've done in the past has been more in kind of the 70 to 80% range. And some, you know, where we've done attainable is even up to like 120%.
Joyce added that in many other communities around the country, affordable housing offered at 80% AMI would reach a large portion of the workforce the city hopes to target. He said in Park City, however, the cost of construction and the simple fact that there are just not many jobs that offer salaries anywhere close to what the AMI level is makes the problem that much more difficult to solve. One potential solution being explored by the city is partnering with private developers. The city will be releasing a request for qualification for the Homestake site near Kearns Boulevard and will be looking for proposals from local developers for 75 to 100 units with an average price of 60% AMI. Additionally, the city is asking for no more than 20% of those units to be market rate. Scott Loomis is the longtime director of the Mountainlands Community Housing Trust and told the council on Thursday that the request is a big ask, but he believes it can be done.
It's extremely difficult to do affordable housing, as most of you know, and to reach these kind of goals, it's extremely difficult, but I think it's doable.
Thursday's events and affordable housing agenda items were discussion items only, and no votes were taken. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Joining me now in the studio with an update from Basin Rec, I have District Director Dana Jones. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you've been on the job now 3 months, learning a lot.
Every day something new, and I just can't believe it's already 3 months.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of moving forward, then, I mean, are you just feel like you got a well-oiled machine at this point?
You know, the folks that work at Basin Rec are just awesome. They know their jobs. They know what they're doing. It just seems like, you know, every day something else comes at us, and we pivot and we turn, and we seem to be doing pretty well.
Okay. Let's see. Let's talk about the short-term trail access plan. What's this about?
You know, looking at this area, you know, Park City, as you know, is a world-class destination. And the trails that Basin Rec has built over the years are really, it's really developed into a world-class trail system. Well, with that comes people and people wanting to use them. And so, as you know, over the years and the last couple years especially, we've really run into some issues with trail crowding and parking especially in, you know, some of the neighborhoods and that kind of thing. You know, it's a growing population in the area, but it's also growing visitation. So, and then over the last year with the COVID pandemic, everybody has decided they want to be outside and healthy. And so this is a place they want to be, and this is where they're coming. So as that community grows, the trail access points are getting more and more crowded. It's becoming more and more of an impact on the community, and we're hearing more and more about that. And so we're really trying to figure out ways to not only, you know, be good partners with our neighborhoods and our community, but also to make sure the trail has access for all those people that want to use it. So we are working on what we call a short-term trail access plan. And it's looking at a number of different things. One of the things it's looking at is transportation. So parking, transit, how to get people to want to go to the trails in a way besides their car. So maybe they're going to ride their bike, or maybe they're going to ride a shuttle and get them to those trailhead points so that we don't have those impacts at the trailhead points. We're also looking at things like dispersal. So rather than everybody wanting to use the same trail, everybody trying to park at Rob's and use that trail, you know, showing some of the other areas and ways to get to other trails that are just as good and just as useful. And that kind of not only reduces the parking issue, but also any kind of overcrowding on the trail system. And then our last thing is always education and enforcement. And I know you've heard about the enforcement patroller that we've hired. But we talk every day with Ben, and he knows that his primary job is education and letting people know, you know, what they can and what they can't do, and how to be good trail users. And I think that has become very, very successful over the past 3, 4, or 5 months since Ben came on board. So our access plan that we're working on is really, like I say, it's a short term. It's a guide for our implementation. And I say that because we're going to, it's not just a plan. It's not just something that we're going to write and then stick on the bookshelf and maybe pull out every once in a while when I get to come on the radio. So it really is something that we're going to be implementing, and we will be implementing parts of that plan, or as much of that plan as we can, starting in the spring when the trails open up a little bit. So
are you working with then the new High Valley Transit District then to try and see about ways to get people out of their cars and onto transit?
We've actually had some meetings with that, and we're seeing how that is going to help us, which I think it really might. Although the new plan, I don't believe, is going to start till mid to late summer. So we're hoping to do some things in the interim to really ease the congestion. So we are looking at each of the trailheads and saying, okay, what can we do to lessen the impact to the neighborhood? What can we do to maybe create a little bit more parking so that people are parking legally and getting to use the trail? But the trail access plan that we're working on, we are getting ready to actually put it online on a website so that the public can take a look at it and see if they would like to comment on it, if they have something, ideas or some things that they want to say about it. And that should be up by the end of this week, I believe.
Okay. And then what about dogs on buses? I mean, because we've heard from some listeners that, you know, it's like they do it in Europe. The dogs are muzzled, so they can't bite anybody. But it's a, you know, it gets, this listener estimated that 85% of the people who are at the trails have a dog.
That is true. And from what I understand, it's because a lot of the places around Salt Lake City don't allow dogs on the trails. So the people are coming over here to be able to walk with their dogs. Now, we have talked to the transit district, and they are not going to be allowing dogs on the new transit system. But we're really exploring maybe some other options, maybe partnering with the transit system ourselves, creating shuttles just for trails and allowing dogs, because it is possible. I have seen it done. I've seen it done on buses and trains. And so I think it's definitely something that we could do, and we are taking a look at that.
So are we talking about kind of every other day with dogs and without dogs, or?
You know, if we were to explore our own trail transit system, then I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be every day.
Okay. And then when you talk about more parking, you know, I think about like the Summit Park trailhead there to Toll Canyon. I mean, it's you have to drive quite a way through the neighborhood only to find out that there's no parking. Is there some way to let people know whether or not there's space available?
You know, there are a number of ways to do that, which we are currently looking at. I mean, there's everything from some kind of sensors in the pavement that say how many spaces are left. I mean, you see it in the parking garage right next door to the studio here. You know, how many spaces are in this area? Airports have them all the time. So possibly some kind of a signage down at the bottom saying, you know, this many parking spaces available, and or here's your overflow parking area, and other ways to get there. So those are also something we're looking at, because I know the neighborhood is impacted by all the cars going up and down, and then. And what I've heard is people actually are driving up there. When there's not a space, they just park there and idle and wait for someone to come off the trail, and which is also a problem.
Yeah. All right, let's see. You've also got the trailhead completion for the Discovery Project. You expect this to get finished this summer?
That is our plan. Mid to late summer, the Discovery Trailhead should be open, which is going to be really exciting because it will provide that access to Toll Canyon. The Toll Canyon trails.
How many spots are going to be there?
Oh, that's a good question. I believe, now I'm going to be totally guessing, but I'm going to say probably 30 to 40 spots are going to be there. It's also going to have a restroom. So it will be a nice trailhead for people to come in, and you don't have to drive all the way through a neighborhood to get to it.
Okay, so that should take maybe some of the pressure off of Summit Park there?
That's what we're hoping. Mm-hmm. Although it just seems like, you know, what they say, if you build it, they will come. So I think as we keep building, they will keep coming.
Okay. And then in terms of the trails, are all trails off leash, or do they all have to have the electronic collar?
You know, some of the trails are okay for off leash, and those are signed as such. Other trails, you have to have your dog on a leash. And then there are other trails that dogs aren't allowed at all because they're watershed and things like that. So we really try to do our best to use some signage so that people really know what they're getting into. Although one of my pet peeves is too many signs. So, I mean, we don't need to litter the environment with 50 dog on leash signs. Strategically placed, I think, is a good way to do that.
Well, especially when people read the sign and don't think it,
applies to them.
Yeah, see that all the time. Let's see, we also got summer camp happening.
Yes, and actually we are moving forward with our summer camp offerings. We have made some modifications for COVID. The numbers are going to be a little smaller. We're going to be working with the kids in pods and moving them around to reduce any kind of potential exposure, that kind of thing. But you parents should be getting some emails and some information. You can also go to our website. Signups are going to start on April 14th. So you might want to mark your calendar if you have a specific camp and a specific date that you want, to make sure that you can get in on that.
Okay. Are they listed on the website at this point?
I believe they are they're going to be listed. Some of them I think are up now, but other ones are going to be coming up in the next couple weeks. So
yeah. And they're hugely popular. You know, you sell out of them. So is there, again, this is a little bit different year, but I mean, is there some talk about expanding that? Do you have the resources or the spaces to do that?
You know, this year we're actually reducing a little because of the COVID numbers. I think that would always be an option to say, do we want to expand existing camps? Is there something that we're not doing that we could be doing? And so that is definitely something we'll look at in the future. I think this year we're overly cautious because we want to make sure all of our folks that come to our camps are safe.
Okay. Anything else, Dana, you want to mention?
I just want to say the weather's getting beautiful, and get outside. And if you have any questions or comments or anything like that, we're happy to hear them. But otherwise, everything that we offer is pretty much on our website.
Okay. Dana, thanks for coming in. We'll see you next month.
Thank you.
It's Dana Jones, the District Director for Centerville Basin Special Recreation District. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, as we've reported, the Centerville Basin Planning Commission March 9th approved a conditional use permit for a group home in Highland Estates. That after hearing voices that praised the facility and others that worried about its impacts. Chairman of the Planning Commission, Ryan Dickey, told us that they came to a decision guided by federal law and that they have set up a list of conditions to mitigate the operation. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more.
The Snyderville Commission granted an approval for a group home along Highland Drive for a transition program called Roots, or Retaining Our Original Truth. The program's founder, Tammy Black, said it is designed to help young girls ages 14 to 18 who are struggling with depression, anxiety, or other trauma. It would use an existing 13,000-square-foot home site. About 20 people spoke in a public hearing. Both sides were heard from, although a majority of the speakers favored the facility. Among the concerned neighbors, Adnis Apostolakis said Roots is a needed and admirable program, but having up to 30 young residents on the site is a big change for what they were told was a residential lot.
You know, it's so hard for me to believe that we were told that was a single-family dwelling, and now we're told, oh yeah, it can handle 30 girls taking showers, dishwashers, laundry, everything that goes on. So there's an incongruency in what we have been told in the past by this body. I don't think any of you were maybe there at that point. So we got this 5 years ago, and now we're being told this is going to happen and this is the right place for it.
But the proposal was praised by industry professionals and past participants in the program. Scott Leventhal called from his home in Connecticut to talk about his own experience.
A couple of years ago, our daughter suffered a violent physical assault. We tried to get her the help that we could in Connecticut and surrounding areas. And we wanted the best for our daughter. Every practitioner out here on the East Coast recommended that we would look into a program that was being run by Cami Black because Cami Black was considered to be the best in this field. Sending our daughter to Utah, 2,000 miles away, was probably the hardest decision that my wife and I ever had to make. Before we took that journey, I vetted Cami Black very thoroughly. And I can tell you, everybody that I spoke to talked extremely well about her and said that she truly is a leader in this field.
Leventhal said his daughter is now doing well in college and aiming for a degree in social service. He asked the neighbors to give Black a chance the way she gave his daughter a chance. The Planning Commission's okay came with several conditions, including a compliance review after a year, no parking on Highland Drive, no subleasing of the property, and fencing on the south and west sides. Ryan Dickey said this kind of application is always tough to decide.
Because the reality is, we need these places, we need these programs, we need a place for teens who have gone through trauma to go and have healing. And I think everyone in the community recognizes that. The reality is, would most citizens of the county want the single-family home next door turned into a group home with 30 residents and seven staff at a time? Of course, the answer is probably no. You want it to exist, but you don't want it next door. But the reality is it has to go somewhere.
He said one factor helping to make the decision is the mandates of the Federal Fair Housing Act.
You can't just say no. You can't say, I just don't think it belongs here because Highland Estates has a lot of other commercial uses and it just seems like too much. You have to say yes to it. We have a lot of examples of places that have said no to it and been hit with multi-million dollar fines under fair housing, all the way up to Boise County in Idaho declaring bankruptcy over a fine for this exact same issue. So I think you heard us start the hearing by saying this is allowed. Feedback that we just don't like it here is not helpful. Let's talk about mitigations.
Snyderville Planning Chairman Ryan Dickey. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
This is KPCW.